Welcome to the Samuel Andreev Podcast. To support this podcast, please visit the donation page of Samuel's website or his Patreon page. There are links in the description. Samuel's Twitter is at Samuel Andreev.
So, welcome to the Samuel Andreev Podcast. I have the immense pleasure of talking today with Luigi Gaggero, who is a very good friend of mine and also an artistic collaborator. We've been working together for many years now, and there are many things I want to talk with Luigi about. And we're going to get to the details of your sort of background and what it is that you do. But I wanted to start off with a question, sort of slightly philosophical, that I think a lot of people are wondering about, because we're recording this on Skype, obviously, because we're both in quarantine. Everybody knows what situation the world is in at the moment. So I'm just curious to have your perspective on this. The news is dominated right now by politics, by economics, by all sorts of worrying statistics and things like this. But one thing you don't see a lot of in the traditional media is the arts right now. And since we're both artists, I'm interested to know, what do you think is the role of an artist, of the arts in a time of crisis?
That's a very good question. So hi to everybody, first of all, and thank you, Samuel, for the invitation to speak about music with you. Yes, I think that to answer your question, we should maybe, first of all, answer the question, what is the role of art in general in our time? And I have to confess that I am maybe a little bit schizophrenic, if I can say this, in the sense that when I play music, when I conduct music, I am incredibly optimistic, so I really give all myself. But when I have to think in general about all the process, about the situation, so when I try to observe myself or the situation from outside, I am a little bit pessimistic. So, because indeed, and I come to your question, I feel that more and more art is losing actually its role. So the original role of art, of any art, is precisely it's kind of place where people can feel safe. So that's the mankind creates art as medicine against the fear, and the basic fears of man is of course the death and not to know what will be after life, and from this original fear we create mythology, we create also art, and through the centuries of course art takes very different forms, but its role of protection from the mystery of death, I think, remains basically the same. The tragedy comes in our society where art actually is losing or has already lost this role and actually is becoming almost useless. And there are some, of course, I could explain very maybe shortly, but I think that the biggest problem is that the communities do not exist anymore. And art, in my opinion, can exist only if there is a community which shares some values, because art can speak about this shared knowledge, shared values. And the world is more and more atomized. So the more we are connected to the internet, the more we are isolated actually as human being. And in general, almost all societies are trying to destroy the communities. And this is also why it's so difficult, more and more difficult, or almost impossible for any art to speak to people, because there is not anymore a shared language, symbolic language, I mean. And that's also why art is losing its main role, which would be to protect us precisely in the moment of danger and to answer our most important questions.
There's a kind of a cliche about contemporary art that its role is not to comfort or to provide some measure of security, but rather to make us question our fundamental beliefs, to make us see the world differently, to put us, maybe to confuse us, maybe to challenge us, and so on. And I think this is actually, these are cliches. And what you are saying is more like the opposite. It's not so much about challenging people as it is about providing a kind of very fundamental, well, responding to a very fundamental human need.
Absolutely, absolutely. Actually, there is, in my opinion, a big misunderstanding, because in the moment that we lose this connection to the transcendence, in this very precise moment, we also lose the meaning of art. And from this point, then we can say, what is art? Then, okay, art is, for example, the individual expression of my ideas or your ideas. But to express an idea or a need, that it's interesting, of course, but it's not art. It's not necessarily art. And the big misunderstanding in contemporary art is, most of the time, of course, there are some exceptions, but most of the time is this is art because this has been done for the first time. So not only in music, but also in, of course, figurative art, for example. And so you have a lot of artists who do something, doesn't matter what, for the first time. And only for this reason, they claim this would be art. But they forget or they don't want to say that you can do maybe something for the first time, but this something can be very stupid or completely irrelevant. So Mozart or Beethoven were great composers not because they were doing something for the first time, even if maybe they were doing also this for the first time. But the real reason is that they were in contact with a higher dimension. And I do believe that the quality of a work of art is really proportional to the quantity, if I may say this, of transcendence which permeates this work of art. And so I really disagree with a historicistic point of view, where actually any language is put on the same level, and it's only about of being original, and then you are already an artist. But I much more believe in a transcendental point of view, so where there is actually an objective parameter to judge a work of art. It's not only about how much original it is. This doesn't mean anything to me.
Okay, so one of the reasons I wanted to talk about these questions with you is you have a very interesting profile. So you're a very well-known soloist. Actually, you're one of the only soloists on the Cymbalom. There aren't that many of them. I mean, there are, from what I understand, most Cymbalom players, at least in Western Europe, are primarily percussionists, right, who've taken up the instrument. Yes. And I think that's the case most of the time, except obviously for people coming out of folkloristic traditions in Hungary and other regions. Yes. So you're trained as a percussionist, you're a Cymbalom soloist, and you've played with pretty much every major orchestra, I would think, at this point in Europe, certainly. You've toured with some extremely fine ensembles. You've done a lot of recording. You're a conductor. You've got a contemporary music ensemble that you work with in Kiev, Ukraine, called Ucho Ensemble, and you're also the conductor of the Kiev State Philharmonic. So you are active in many, many different things, but you are simultaneously active in the classical repertoire that you conduct with the orchestra and also the pieces that you play as a soloist. And you're also very active in contemporary creation. So you have kind of a double vision on all of this. When you talk to us about transcendence and the need to create a transcendental experience through art, How has that manifested in your different practices? How do you attempt to bring that about?
I think that the secret, if there is a secret, is precisely try to avoid any difference in the approach. Or if I can say the same thing with other words, I try to avoid a kind of specialization, although, of course, I could also say that I am specialist of modern or contemporary repertoire, since this, I have been playing this repertoire for 25 years. But the fact is that if you isolate this repertoire from the history of music, then indeed you really risk to lose this connection with transcendence. I think, of course, music is very different through the centuries, but if we keep in mind that true art is always answering to the same questions, then actually our approach never changes. I also think that doesn't matter if you are approaching Mozart or Kurtag, a real interpretation is always an encounter. And in this encounter, let's say composer and performer are there 50-50. So no one should occupy the 50% of space of the other person, which means, first of all, the performer should be at least a little bit conscious of his own aesthetic values in order to recognize the difference between his own aesthetic values and the values expressed from the composer whom he is playing. Because otherwise, and this is the danger, we are playing projective interpretations. So where I project on the composer my own values. So there are sometimes an interpretation can also succeed like this. I mean, if your inner world, I could name an incredible great artist like Furtwängler, for example. Of course, he was conducting, I would maybe dare to say he was most conducting Furtwängler most of the time. Many composers, many different composers whom he's playing sound a little bit in the same way. But he's, let's say, a very lucky exception, because his world, he was such a genius that even if he's playing himself, still the interpretation is incredibly interesting and deep. But most of the time, we cannot compare us, unfortunately, with such genius. So if we just play ourselves, it's only manipulation. It's only we are just raping, actually, the music which we are supposed to play. So once again, be conscious. The first step would be to be conscious of our own aesthetic, to see it, and to see the difference with the aesthetic of the composer, which is of course different, and then to try to create a real, a sincere encounter. From this encounter come something completely new, which is different from me, which is different from the composer. But this is precisely what makes the interpretation unique, sincere, and also actual. Speaking of the time, and I think this is the same regardless of your playing Mozart or Andreev.
I think one of the issues that we see in the classical world today is there's a kind of a star system in place where you have extremely well-known personalities who get a lot of media attention. You know, they'll tend to get more attention and be placed more prominently on the posters than the composers themselves. And I'm not sure that that's necessarily a bad thing, because you want people to go to the concerts and you want there to be a kind of aura and a sense of excitement about the events. And I completely understand that. But when you're talking about the need to have a kind of a balance between the interpreter and the composer, it seems to me that we're often getting a little bit away from that. And we know that audiences very often, they'll be more inclined to go and hear a particular soloist play a particular concerto but not be so concerned about who the composer is of the piece. So in other words, if it's Hilary Hahn playing, you know, the concert hall will be full. Yes. It doesn't seem to matter too much what she's actually playing.
Yes. Now, of course, to be a great star doesn't mean, I think, necessarily to forget that a real musician should be a servant, actually, of the music which he is playing. So there are, I think, fortunately, some great stars who still can bring to the public Beethoven or Mozart, and in this case, then it's good, because maybe people go indeed to the concert of these stars, but then they can really discover the composer. But most of the time, it is true that we have many famous musicians which actually are exploiting the music. They are playing just to show off, so just to like a pretext to play themselves, and this is very dangerous, because most of people, of course, cannot recognize how the music is distorted from this, and how the music is misunderstood and used and abused, and so they go away. They leave the concert with a completely wrong idea, and this is of course very, very dangerous. In addition to that, I think also that maybe this is in particular for speaking about conductors. We live in a particular time, because at the beginning of the century, we had really stars who at the same time were also great musicians. I think about once again Furtwängler or Karajan or Toscanini. So of course they were very charming, very fascinating personalities, stars indeed, but nevertheless they were also great musicians. And in my humble opinion, there is something very interesting which happens then to the next generations. So the generation of conductors who today are about 70 or 80 years old, which means they take the heritage of this gravitas, so of this being conductor, being maestro with a capital M from the previous generation. But what happens is that unconsciously, or sometimes consciously, but they are not only musically, but anthropologically against the model, the anthropological model which is represented from this previous generation. I make an example. I don't know now what Abbado was saying, or really in his interviews, about the meaning of conducting. I mean, I know a little bit, but I don't know if he would have agreed on this. But from his way of conducting, it is quite clear to me that he's Adornian. So his reference is Adorno, his way of his ethic values. But the thing is that this being a maestro, so the way that he has as conductor is not necessarily connected with Adornian values, but it's much more connected to the, once again, Toscanini or Furtwängler. And this technique is, in my opinion, not compatible with the values of this generation.
Okay, so, so I'm going to jump in here. So maybe you can explain this to us. So what do you mean by Adornian values as pertaining to a musical interpretation?
Okay, I can maybe try to make a concrete example so that to help us. For example, if we take Karajan was an incredible conductor, and many of us have the picture of him conducting with closed eyes, for example. And also these videos, he was also very attentive how to shoot the video. So the videos are really expressing with the image also his way of thinking music and thinking conducting. And actually, he has closed eyes. He's deeply concentrated in himself, and he wants the music so much. So it's really about wanting. He wants these phrasings so much that empathically, all the community, which is the orchestra, feels this and does exactly what he wants. So the communication is really, I could use, and not by chance, the title of the film of Leni Riefenstahl, who was, by the way, the National Socialistic regisseur. So the Triumph of the Will. And when I see Karajan conducting, I really think my immediate association is the Triumph of the Will. He wants something so much, and he has a magic power to let the community, the orchestra, feel the same. Now, this magic aura, which is going in this empathic and non-democratic way to the people, is really very far away from the aesthetic, ethic values of the generation after the war, of course. And if we speak once again, I was speaking about Adorno, but in general, I could also say someone who simply shares a democratic point of view, he will be, of course, against, deeply against, of an attitude where actually you simply are an instrument of the will of a leader, of a charismatic leader, of a Führer, actually, one could say. Adornian philosophy is much more questioning. So the key word is not I want something and you will be also wanting what I want, but it's much more let's try to understand what is behind this. So let's question, let's ask together what does it mean. So it's more a way of about questions. And I think Abbado, as many great artists of that generation, is much more in symphony with this attitude, of course.
Although Abbado was famous for not really saying much in rehearsals and for being kind of shy and a little bit inarticulate in interviews.
Exactly, and there is the short circuit. But I'm not speaking about Abbado, of course, but let's say in general about the figure of maestro in this time, which means the feeling, so the heart of our generation, or already the two last generations, is trying to find again something stable, so a truth on which we can rely on. But at the same time, the technique, so as you say, he was actually, of course, his technique is different from Furtwängler, but the attitude, once again, he was not speaking, so everything is in his baton. So he shares, once again, the technique of the previous generation who was thinking, once again, differently, for example, like this Triumph of the Will. And for me, this is the contradiction. So to have a technique which is too much connected with the vision which was there until the Second World War, and the attitude, the spiritual attitude of the generation after, which of course cannot be the same, but still is trying to use the same technique, conducting technique. And so the challenge for me is for our generation of conductors is how to find a way of conducting music where still the conductors is useful, but in a contemporary way, so in a modern way, so not like Furtwängler, not like Karajan, so to shape the new role and the new technique of the 21st century conductor. I think this is the great challenge, because one possible answer is let's get rid of the conductor. And there are indeed some great orchestras. I think, for example, about Les Dissonances of David Grimal, who indeed play actually anything and play fantastically good. And they play without conductor, indeed, because they feel that not being able of being a great charismatic and deep person anymore, the conductor actually only stays in between the musician and the music. So let's just listen each other together and let's play music. Of course, there has been a reaction in the 60s, I think, about of conductors like Boulez, who were actually a kind of anti-Karajan in a way. So starting from this transcendental approach, a la Furtwängler, from a very Cartesian approach, so mathematical, geometric, where emotion was completely cancelled. No? But this also, still, art is transcendental. So this way, this moment was probably necessary as a reaction, but it cannot be the last answer. And indeed, today we are searching for something else.
Yeah, one figure that really made an impression on me, certainly when I was quite young, but also today as well, is Glenn Gould, who I think is very interesting in this respect, because he was one of the first major classical artists to discuss publicly the major influence that recording technology was having on the interpretation of music. And this was something that his peers and his colleagues weren't really discussing. So for example, I want to tie this back to some of the projects that we've been doing together and something that you've been doing a lot of also, which is recording. So a lot of his peers and colleagues, people like Yehudi Menuhin, for example, or Leopold Stokowski, there's many, many, Stokowski's older than Gould, obviously, but people of that generation and also of his generation were very reluctant to give too much of a place to the microphone. In other words, they would make records the same way that they would prepare a concert. So the idea would be, well, we'll just pretend that we're giving a concert and there'll be microphones there. And his position was, this is actually very different. It's like the difference between staging a play and making a film. And so when you have recording technology, you have the opportunity to present the music in a much more considered and maybe even analytical way, in a way that would not be possible when you're beholden to the sort of spontaneous emotion and intensity of a live performance. And so he was extremely creative with his approach to recording, and there's a lot of controversy, obviously, about what he did, and some people are very fanatically opposed to his point of view, but at least he was willing to consider these things carefully. So how do you feel about, first of all, his position on recording, and what do you think the legacy has been of the enormous apparatus of the recording industry on not only interpretation but also perhaps on composition itself?
I totally agree, actually, with the vision of Glenn Gould, and I think actually there are two ways, in my opinion, to consider a recording. Or we have or the recording is a memory, or the memory of a live performance, or indeed I think we should use the possibilities of a studio recording session to achieve maybe not more than on a stage, but in a different way than on a stage. We should achieve our ideal interpretation. I think that the market is a little bit oversaturated from many recordings which are not one thing and not the other. So they are studio recording, so they lose indeed the freshness, the energy of a live performance. But at the same time, there is not this questioning, this musical research of spiritual perfection. So they simply sound, yes, perfect, so correct, but boring. And I think that we should indeed, as some artists still do, but I think they are a minority today, to use the potential of studio recording in a for what it is. So you can do something which you could not do on stage. So you can do it, you can exploit this, but while trying not to lose the freshness of a live performance.
Well, there's a major difference there between, for example, recording a recital album of solo piano pieces and recording a CD of orchestral compositions, because the economics are vastly different. So if you're recording a CD of sonatas by Haydn, you can probably afford to take a month and you know, go in with an engineer and try out different ways of presenting the pieces. With an orchestra, that's more or less impossible most of the time. And what you do see a great deal of in the classical market are essentially CDs of live performances that have been cleaned up a little bit. So you record the concert and you record the general rehearsal, and maybe you do a little montage of the two versions. And that's probably most of what you see in terms of orchestral recordings.
Yes.
So what would you think would be an interesting approach forwards with something like orchestral recording, given that the economics, once again, are incredibly complicated, especially considering that many, many orchestras throughout Europe and North America are under intense financial stress all the time?
Okay, I can give two answers, which are a little bit different. The first answer is, is personal, because what you say is precisely why I feel so lucky to work in Ukraine, because for different reasons. One thing that we do have, both with the ensemble, with UCHO Ensemble, and with the Kyiv Symphony Orchestra, of which I am chief conductor. So with both formations, we have basically unlimited time. And this is incredible. This is actually a dream, precisely because we can prepare not only recording, but also a concert for 1-2 weeks. With the ensemble, we work like 10 days for a concert, rehearsing 7 hours a day. And indeed, in the Western world, this would be simply impossible, because no one can pay, I think, an ensemble or an orchestra for 7 hours a day for 10 days for a project. So indeed, this is like a kind of paradise for a conductor, because I really can work on the slightest detail, at least I can try, in order to get close to the as close as I can to my vision. The second answer maybe sounds a little bit like a contradiction of what I have just said, but I think that it is true that most of the ensemble of orchestras in the world usually can work like 2-3 days of rehearsals and then play the concert or the live CD. But still, I think that the biggest problem is not the time. Of course, the time is also a problem, as I just said. But the thing is that is the vision, actually. So even if you have only 2 days of time, even if you have only a live recording, still the question is how long and how deep you have been preparing yourself for those two rehearsals. And still there are great musicians, also very famous musicians, who still find the time to prepare 10, 20, 30 years for a concert. No? There have been artists like Rubinstein who still, when he was 70 years old, was already an amazing pianist. Still, he was keeping studying. And when he was 80, he was playing better than he was 70. So that's something incredible. So there are other musicians, more or less famous, who prepare a piece in 2 weeks, and then of course, if you study 2 weeks a piece, or 3 weeks, or one month for any symphony, then you can also have 6 months of rehearsals. But it's very unlikely that you will do something interesting.
In order to help keep this podcast going, I've decided to accept some highly select sponsors that I think could really make your life better. On this episode, I'd like to welcome my new sponsor, Encoda. That's N-K-O-D-A. If I had to sum up Encoda in a few words, it's basically the Spotify of sheet music. It's available on all major platforms, including iOS, Android, Mac, and Windows. If you've ever wanted to look at a score for study purposes or just check out some potential repertoire without wanting to pay full price, Encoda is your solution. They have an extensive library of tens of thousands of scores from all periods, all styles, and many different publishers. You can view high-resolution scores and parts. The app is easy to navigate and is a pleasure to use. Download it from your app store or start a free trial and see for yourself. And if you like it, it's available on a subscription basis. That's nkoda.com.
There are obviously structural problems with the way a lot of orchestras are set up in Western Europe. I'm not sure what the solution is to that exactly, because if you have very, very tight union regulations, because obviously you want the musicians to be able to make a decent living and to not be experiencing too much economic hardship. You want to be able to do a significant enough number of concerts so that you can put together a coherent season without having to wait, 4 months between concerts or something. But all of this is incredibly expensive. And yeah. So what tends to happen, as you say, is the rehearsals are reduced to a strict minimum. And everybody is under pressure to do things very, very quickly all the time. And that does seem to be a major problem. I mean, when you think about more traditional musical cultures or musical cultures that exist in other parts of the world, you tend to see much more of a sense of shared community, as you mentioned earlier in the podcast, and an approach towards the music that is not so much an approach of work, but of coming together to do something meaningful.
Exactly.
So why do you think it is? I mean, obviously, Ukraine has a very different situation than the Western European countries, but I don't think that's all of the story. And why is it that you think it's possible to achieve that sort of a vision in Ukraine, and instead of, say, London or Paris or Berlin or New York?
I think that's... The biggest difference is a difference of attitude. I was mentioning before that, of course, we have also a lot of time, which is also usually not possible in Western Europe. But I think that's not the main reason why in Ukraine is different. For in my experience, and the main difference is. That for the Western musician, to be a professional musician is at the same time kind of mask, if I can say like this, which means, okay, I am very good professional player. I can play this passage piano, forte, staccato, legato, legatissimo, and I can play anything you want on my instrument because I master this instrument incredibly good. And you, as a conductor or colleague, you just tell me what should I do, and I do it at a very, very high professional level. But at the same time, the non-spoken part of this message is, and then please leave me alone, which means I can give you all my professional parts, which is also very high, but let's not speak too much about soul, about my person. So I don't want to be aggressive as a human being while I'm in an orchestra or in a rehearsal. So you as a composer, if you are, for example, asking me things, or as a conductor, you should never trespass. So there is like a kind of wall between us, which is the wall of the professionalism. So just give me a concrete information about how this needs to be done, and I will do it. But actually, you can never or almost never touch the why it should be like this. Because why, if we are speaking seriously about why, it always touches the person. So it's impossible to make music speaking about the reasons of this making music without touching the person. And in most of the time, immediately in our society, when we start touching the person, the defense is immediately there. No, okay, you cannot touch my person. And in Ukraine, because of the different history, the attitude is the opposite. So the musicians are really asking not how, but why something should be like this. So they are much more ready to invest themselves as human beings first than as musicians in the music they are playing. And this makes possible to work on a different level with the orchestra or with the ensemble. And I think that the result is then that the interpretation sounds much more vibrating than usual. Of course, I don't want now to speak bad of our society, because of course there are good exceptions, but exactly there are exceptions in our society. While there, I would say, regardless of the technical level of the musicians, there are of course better or worse players as anywhere, but they all share, almost all share this being open, and you don't get this don't touch me immediately.
That's something that I've observed as well. I mean, we've worked on some projects, a number of projects in Ukraine together, and I've been struck by the fact that there's a feeling of engagement that goes very, very deep. And that is very impressive. And as you say, it's a separate question from the question of technique, of being able to play a C-sharp minor arpeggio extremely quickly at any possible dynamic level. This is not the sort of thing that we're discussing. So I was very, very impressed by that as soon as I started working with.
Yeah. And if I may say, sorry, but this is a very important point also in education, in music, because our society most of the time has separate how from why. And there are today in France or Germany or Italy, it's very easy to find, or quite easy to find, great instrumentalists. So to find flutists, clarinet players who play incredibly good, for example. But the problem is precisely that the question is never how you are doing something, but why you are doing that. And I always teach to my, I try, for example, to teach to my students also that when they ask me, but how should I do this? And usually the technical answers should come in the moment that you really understand and feel what you want. And then your body will find almost by itself the right technical movement. And if you just isolate the movement, separating from the motivation, then you have maybe it functions, so it works good, but actually it doesn't mean anything, that movement. So you will be playing correctly, but also it will be meaningless what you are saying, what you are playing. And this is a little bit, the danger of our society.
You know the conversation books that Robert Kraft and Igor Stravinsky published? Mm-hmm. Yeah, so there's a wonderful exchange, which to me sounds authentic. Obviously, we don't know exactly how many of the words came from Stravinsky, but so Kraft asked Stravinsky, what is your definition of technique? And Stravinsky's reply was, the whole man. Yeah. And I think this is what you're talking about. In other words, technique, it has nothing to do with being able to play X number of notes in X number of seconds, but rather it's your ability to bring the entire human apparatus to bear on the task at hand, so that nothing is left out. It must be complete. And I believe that very strongly. And this is something that I always aim for as a composer or in anything that I try to do. You have to bring everything to the task at hand and spare nothing.
Yes, absolutely. And folks, I often say that technique is an emanation of the soul, but I think that's very close to the words of Stravinsky. And this is particularly true, maybe really also for conducting, for example, because the movements of a conductor, but I actually could say the same as a percussionist or cymbalum player. You were asking at the beginning a little bit about a different profile and the differences and so on. Actually, being percussionist, cymbalum player, and conductor, these three activities share something in common, and this is that the perfect technical movement for conducting or playing percussion is actually the movement that you would do as a non-musician, not musician, to express the same feeling in a healthy moment of your everyday life. So, when you are, drinking a glass of water, you don't think about your muscles. No, you just simply take the glass of water, you bring it to your mouth, and then you start drinking, without thinking about what your tongue is doing. It would be impossible to drink. And actually, or when we want to embrace someone because we love this person, or when we are angry and we say no and we smash the hand against the table. So all these movements, we haven't practiced them. And nevertheless, they express perfectly our emotion. And I think that the right technique for percussion or conducting should be built exactly in the same way. So it's not about repeating movements which work, but it's about to recreate this bridge, this connection between recreating a feeling in yourself, in your soul, and a bridge to an unconscious, almost unconscious body expression of this feeling.
It's very interesting. It's very, very interesting, and it's certainly very different from the vast majority, I would say, of the way a lot of teachers function in conservatories and in other places.
I fear, yes.
Yeah. So, maybe the education in Ukraine is simply different. Maybe the musical tradition operates a little bit differently than it does in Western Europe, and the sort of set of values is different. And that I'm sure because. I can't think of how you could explain this difference otherwise. It doesn't just happen by accident. So there must be something in the educational approach.
I think probably one difference is not really, it's not very much about the musical education, but the education and the spirit of the society in general. Because we in West Europe, we are really very positivistic, and for example, the state, any state, not only in France, is constantly asking to the teachers, to the directors of the academies, to quantify how all the quality and the activities that they are doing. So a director of the academy should actually answer numbers. So we had now 1,000 students more, or we have more people who took a diploma, or the notes at the diplomas in our school are higher than in other schools. So you need always something that you can name and quantify. But the problem is that you cannot quantify quality. So anything that a director of academy can name is irrelevant from the point of view of truth, actually. So you can, of course, say my academy is organizing hundreds concerts in a year instead of this other academy which is organizing 20. So, of course, 100 is five times more than 20. But no one can objectively measure the quality of those 100 concerts. But that would be the thing to name, not how many, but how good or how bad those concerts were. And that's the problem. But our society never considers this part, which is actually the essential part.
Let's talk about that in relationship to your work with the Ujo Ensemble, which I'm interested in, because you mentioned earlier that you think that it's dangerous to be a specialist. Because we were talking about the fact that you're a soloist, you're a conductor, you work with these two ensembles, you're very busy. You do a lot of recording projects. So let's talk about this, because we've seen the emergence, particularly in North America and Western Europe, of these highly specialized ensembles, and I think this really is something that started in the early 1970s with the Ensemble Moderne, with the London Sinfoniada, the Ensemble Intercontemporain, all of these groups that have approximately 20 musicians, you know, so you can play chamber music, you can play ensemble pieces and so on, up to maybe 20, 22 players, something like this. And the particularity of these ensembles is that by and large, they only play music of a very restricted period, which tends to be music from the post-war up until today, let's say, and actually, a lot of those ensembles today don't even really play immediate post-war repertoire anymore. They might only play repertoire from the past 10 to 20 years, depending on how focused they are on giving premieres. So how do you feel about the evolution of these sorts of ensembles and their place in the musical landscape, given that you don't seem to like specialization very much?
Yes, I think that with these ensembles, we have two problems, actually. But first of all, I should say that I also don't want to be misunderstood, because, of course, these ensembles are, and in particular, have been very important in a specific moment, so in the 60s, in the 70s, to help the creation, so to help composers to write music and to maybe even to save the destiny of classical music of that time in a certain period. But to answer your questions, I would say that I think that there is not a big future for these ensembles. The more and more that this repertoire will be played from traditional musicians, so traditional orchestras, or musicians who have, let's say, a classical background. Also because today, if you take a student, a good student of academy, he is usually, or she is usually, comfortable with multiphonic of many techniques of contemporary music. So actually, we don't need those specialized players anymore, because the words are not so separate anymore. But actually, there is maybe an aspect which is more important to me, which is this. Of course, if we speak about ensembles like Ensemble Contemporain, Ensemble Moderne, we speak also about a specific way of playing. So not only about what, so about the repertoire, but also there is also an aesthetic of the interpretation. And we should never forget that Boulez, for example, he was a structuralist. So his approach was a structuralist approach.
And what does that mean in a musical sense?
It means this. Boulez, for example, was saying, I quote him, I think, word by word, we should colonize time by calculating. Il faut coloniser le temps en calculant. And then he says, and any rhythmical structure can be reduced to a procession of two or three, which means pam 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 or pam 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 pam. And anything, so bigger than two or three, can be reduced. So five can be two plus three, or seven can be, you know, and so on. And this need of calculation, what does it mean? It is actually an attempt to kill the sacralization of time. Because, of course, if you think that the time has something sacred, like I would say almost any artist before, once again, you cannot count sacred time, precisely because the sacred time is different from the everyday time. And of course, as a reaction, as a cultural reaction to the transcendence, we have a part of the West European culture which tries to answer and say, no, transcendence does not exist, and we can measure everything, and we can also do art without transcendence, but simply by measuring things. We can maybe understand even better this sentence, quotation by Boulez, if you think about the French architect Le Corbusier, who actually was working in the same time. And one famous sentence of Le Corbusier was, a house is a machine to live in. We were speaking at the beginning about what is art. You know, art is a kind of sacred, safe place where we can protect our fear. And to say that a house is a machine means precisely to destroy any symbolic element. So the reason why we created houses at the very beginning, and to reduce any house to walls without any transcendental, which means symbolic meaning. Boulez tries to do the same thing with music, probably with his music as a composer, but with any music when he's conducting it. And now the problem is, it's not very much about Le Corbusier or Boulez, who did the work, and one can judge by himself if they are good or not. But the problem is that the following generation, and I now speak again specifically about conductors, the following generations of conductor, of specialized conductors, has basically taken the technique of Boulez, so this and this calculation, so yeah, pa 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 pa, but without sharing, without actually knowing, or without sharing the Weltanschauung, so the vision of the world of Boulez. So there is really a big contradiction in this case, because there are conductors who only count music, but Boulez was doing this at least in name of a vision which was articulated, and one can agree or one cannot agree, but he was aware of what he was doing. And most of the time, specialization for conductors of contemporary music today means only to copy the physical part of Boulez movements, but without sharing his point of view, which means you cannot actually conduct at all, because if you have a technique where you destroy the flowing of time, and you only calculate it, and you only make pam 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 pam, and then you ask the musician to play a legato, to play musically, to search some, for some beauty, you only disturb them because your movements are in contradiction with what you are asking. And this is, in my opinion, what is happening the 90% of the time, so that the conductor is not aware of this contradiction. He's trying to make music in a classical way, and then he has this gesture which syllabates everything and destroys what he's asking for, and it doesn't work. And probably this is also why specialization cannot exist anymore, if specialization takes this form. But this is also the form which is taken most of the time.
So your view then is that these sort of specialized ensembles, they won't be necessary, because on the one hand, you do have a number of very great composers of the 20th century whose work is being performed in increasing numbers by people who are absolutely not specialists in contemporary music. So take, for example, the piano etudes of Ligeti. A very, very large number of pianists play those pieces, and they don't have to be salaried performers with the Ensemble Moderne, for example, in order to do that. Kurtag is another example.
Yes.
And I see this as being a very encouraging sign. And yes. And of course, you would hope that great composers like this can be sort of taken out of the ghetto of the sort of contemporary music world and brought into a much larger musical context. At the same time, though, it's also true that for composers, it's tremendously difficult to get performed. And so there's a sort of, what would you say, a kind of safety valve, which is, having pieces performed maybe once by a specialist ensemble, or maybe during a workshop or a festival academy or something like this, just in order to have it be played at all. And so you have very large numbers of composers that basically only exist in that circuit, right? So they'll be played at the festivals, they'll be played at Darmstadt, Donaueschingen, and so on, and maybe they'll have a piece at a festival now and then. But most of these pieces will be performed once. The vast majority of them never get played a second time. Yeah. And when you attend these festivals, which I don't really do anymore, but I did at one point, you quickly have the impression that the names of the composers are completely interchangeable. It actually doesn't matter who's on the program, because the experience that you have is going to be approximately the same. Yes. So on the one hand, you can understand the anxiety of a younger composer starting now, who simply wants to be performed. But you can also see very clearly that this is in many respects, from an artistic point of view, from a human point of view, it's not a very satisfying state of affairs. At the same time, it isn't as though every single composer out there can be performed by the London Symphony Orchestra or the Berlin Philharmonic or the Kiev Philharmonic Orchestra. I mean, there's only so many composers that you can absorb and that can be performed. So how do you view the evolution of this situation, where you have very large numbers of composers coming out of graduate schools with degrees, hoping to get performed, and being confronted with a situation where it's incredibly difficult, and in some cases even impossible?
Indeed, it's not easy. So I think, first of all, that the risk for the ensemble of contemporary music, is that they will become probably redundant if, and this is the point, if the aesthetic will be like it is now for many of them. Of course, once again, not all of them, but many of them, which means this post-structuralist aesthetic. Because in this case, we don't need this, I think, we don't need this particular approach anymore. And this specialization today is useless, because classical players also can, in the sense that are able to play the same thing. So the paradox is, I think that contemporary ensemble can survive also in the future if their players will be not specialists. So and so we can see, in my opinion, the ensemble as a different formation, like I don't know, there is an orchestra, there is a chamber orchestra, there is a string quartet, there is then an ensemble. But the profile, the musical profile of the musician should not be different. So, and for example, that's why when I was making an audition for Oko Ensemble, I was basically asking only Mozart, because I was thinking, even if I have someone who cannot play a multiphonic, which in the end was not the case, but I was sure that if you are not able to play a specific technique in 2 weeks or 3 weeks, in 1 month you will learn to play it if you are a good musician. While if you cannot play legato, this is not something that you can play that you can learn in 3 weeks, because
right.
The 10 years will be maybe not be enough. So that's why for me it's important that. That everybody is able to play Mozart, so to speak, and from that starting point, then to play Kurtág or even Boulez, then it's much easier than if you have two musicians who can play 7 against 5 against 3 very rapidly, but then they cannot feel the harmonies as they were playing Schumann. Because there is no difference in this sense if you play Kurtág or Schumann. It's exactly the same thing. So this is the first part of the answer. And the second, yes, of course, for young composers, it is indeed, I see, of course, it's very difficult. I think that from one side, it's important that the ensemble, specialized ensemble with not specialized players, will keep existing, and of course they can work with young musicians. This is also what I am doing with Oko Ensemble. We were doing every year composers master classes where we were performing many pieces of young composers. So this is something that I think every ensemble should do. But also I hope that for traditional orchestras, that they will play more and more contemporary music. Of course, this thing is in process. Of course, today orchestras are playing much more contemporary music than what they were doing 40 years ago. But still, this is by far not enough what we are doing right now. So this should be improved. But of course, this doesn't depend that much from the young composers, but it depends much more from the lucidity, from the intelligence of the artistic directors and the conductors of those orchestras.
Yes, although I've also heard the other side of the story, because I've heard from people who are marketing directors and people who are involved in fundraising for orchestras, who say that the problem is that it's not that orchestras aren't intelligent or aesthetically open-minded. It's that if they play certain pieces, let's say if they were to play Gruppen by Stockhausen, Gruppen isn't even a good example, because that piece tends to sell out concert halls because it's very spectacular.
Yes.
But let's say if you were to play a piece by a much less well-known composer on a major symphony orchestra program, they know that they're taking a massive financial risk, that they're going to sell fewer tickets, and that it's going to impact their budget for the entire season. And they have to be pragmatic, because they constantly face economic catastrophe all the time. And so the situation is also complicated. And I can sympathize with that point of view. But then at the same time, you have someone like Stockhausen, who in an interview said, the orchestras are doing this completely backwards. They play mainly classical repertoire, and actually a very, very narrow range of classical repertoire, because it's the same four or five names that you see in every concert practically. And occasionally they'll play a little 10-minute piece that was composed recently, and he said it should be the opposite. They should mainly be playing contemporary compositions and a little bit of classical repertoire, so that we have a sense of historical continuity. So there's a tremendous tension between those two points of view, between on the one hand saying, well, yes, but pragmatically, if we do that, our audience will disappear. And then on the other hand saying, it should be very radically biased in favor of contemporary music.
I actually disagree with both points of view, in the sense that I could answer to the first ones, which means to the managers. Of course, I see that the problem, but at the same time, I also don't think that if you are playing in a concert three or four composers, as orchestras are usually doing in almost any concert, and if you have three great famous composers and one young composer, I don't think that this will affect incredibly how many tickets you are selling. So I really don't believe this. So I think that it should still be possible to integrate contemporary pieces in the traditional repertoire. And also the danger is, my opinion, much more a musical one, which means one should avoid, because this is also a problem, because sometimes you see because it's a dangerous weapon, of course, because of course if you have an unknown composer and then you have a program like Beethoven and the unknown composer, you are probably not doing a good service to the young composer.
Right.
because then the public will say, okay, Beethoven was better. So the thing is that an artistic director should be intelligent enough to create an intelligent and real connection between the past and the new piece or the recent piece that you perform. So to create a kind of profound dialogue between that young voice or the contemporary voice and the past, so that regardless of the how big, how giant is the Beethoven or whatever, still you can make this dialogue very interesting, because this is possible. So the thing is that my first answer is yes, you can play contemporary music, you can program it inside a more classical program, just being very careful that you do it in an intelligent way, otherwise you will actually not do a good service to the contemporary music. The second answer is to Stockhausen. Because although I have spent 25 years of my life playing mostly contemporary music, I think the truth is that, speaking very honestly, I don't believe that today we have the same quality as a number. Of course, one could say yes, but also in the past we have selected a lot of composers, and we have always Bach, Schumann, Schubert, Brahms, and a few others. But still, even if you take only 60 years in the past, it would be very difficult, in my opinion, to name today 6-7 composers, living composers, who can really be compared to Schumann, Schubert, or this thing. So the first part of my answer to Stockhausen would be, you cannot ignore that the modernity most of the time doesn't produce the same quality as the past. I'm sorry, but I would not exchange or say put one-to-one a building by Le Corbusier with Notre Dame of Paris. I would actually not exchange for the all the buildings of Le Corbusier, and probably not even a wall of Notre Dame. So this cannot be forgotten, in my opinion. And the second answer is, the second part of the answer is that the sentence by Stockhausen seems to imply that the present is better because it is present. And I strongly disagree with this, because Bach is not less present, is not less contemporary than Stockhausen or Boulez or Kurtág. So, once again, if you have a historicistic point of view, then you will probably think like Stockhausen, because this is very, maybe let's spend 1 minute about this, because this is a very important point for me. Of course, if you think that every language has the same right to exist, so you cannot say that that classical music is better than techno music, it's simply two different form of languages. Because there is not an external parameter with which you can judge and measure the inner quality of this form of art, then of course, then you can say this work is better or worse only in relationship to how this composer is using the language. So in this case, in a historicistic point of view, Mozart is a good or better or worse composer than Salieri, for example, according or judging how he's using his language of that time. But the language itself cannot be judged, of course, according to this point of view. And if you think like this, of course, all languages are the same, because you cannot compare them with each other. But this means that every language is the same, but the last language, so the most modern one, is slightly better than the other ones, because at least it is modern, no? So in this case, you could say, okay, contemporary music, the contemporary language or languages are not better or worse than the classical language, because you cannot compare them, but at least the contemporary languages are contemporary, while the other ones are old languages. So you already feel a little bit of dust on Mozart or Aristoteles or Platon or Shakespeare. When you think differently, when you think, as I do think, that the quality of not only of a composer, but also of a language as such depends on how much transcendence is in that language, then when this piece or work of art has been produced, it doesn't play any role. So because the actuality, so the being contemporary, being actual, being important for a society of a work of art is not when it has been composed, but it is how much transcendence, which is how much transcendence is present. And this is eternal. This is is not connected to a mode or to a specific time. So I don't feel that, once again, Beethoven or Bach are less contemporary. Actually, I would say the opposite. The 90% of contemporary works of art are much more actually art and contemporary than Bach or Giotto. So that's why I don't see the problem to play a lot of Beethoven together with contemporary music.
I would say a few things about that. So one of them is, I don't take Stockhausen's quote literally, because I don't think that what he actually meant was orchestras should program more pieces by Carl Goyvertz and Henri Pousseur and Bo Nielsen and Christian Wolff and et cetera, et cetera. I think what he meant was they should play more Stockhausen.
Yes.
Right. I think that's what we're meant to understand by that.
Yes.
by that quote, really. And then the other thing, okay, so you mentioned that you understand, of course, that there's a certain historical triage that happens where you don't retain all of the repertoire of a given period. And this is why you do see the same names come up again and again on programs. You see, you're much likelier to see a piece by Schumann on a program than you are to see a piece by Reinecke, for example.
Yes.
So that's in many respects a good thing, because for every Schumann, for every Schubert, there were 500 composers writing mediocre salon pieces that may be actually extremely bad. And so that repertoire is very, very low priority. The only times that you see pieces like that be played are for instruments that have a very limited repertoire. So, for example, if you play the oboe or the English horn and you need a recital piece, then you might be interested to know that there's a 19th century composer called Carlo Ivan who wrote an English horn sonata. It's the only one written in the entire 19th century. So it's kind of an interesting historical curiosity. So it's a terrible piece, but again, it's played because it's the only piece from that period. So those sorts of things, when there's a kind of an interesting historical contingency, they might get performed. But the point is, there's vast amounts of repertoire that is basically forgettable and forgotten for that reason. And there's no reason to assume that the percentage, let's say, of remarkable pieces or pieces that have something urgent and authentic and important about them is smaller on average today per capita, let's say, than it was at that time. I think there is a big difference, which is that there's a lot more noise in the culture today than there would have been 200 years ago. So for example, because of the internet, because of globalization, because of the ease of travel, we know far more about what's happening in every region of the world instantly than we ever did before. And we're just in contact with more names, with more artists, with more music, much more easily than could ever have been the case. So if you were a composer living in Stuttgart in 1754, you didn't know or care who the contemporary composers in Finland were, right? And today the situation is extremely different. So I think that's also part of it. So I understand your argument. I'm not completely convinced by the idea that there's been a global lowering in quality in terms of the work. I think there's a great deal more work being presented by a lot of composers that probably shouldn't be composers. And there are various structural reasons for why that is. But I don't think you can really say that human ingenuity or creativity is lesser today than it was 200 years ago.
But this is also this is not what I wanted to say either. For me, the problem is that let's say like this: the situation, the context has changed. And once again, is for me, in my opinion, the problem is that today, without, because it is true that we have much more connection, but at the same time, it is also true that if you take a society, it is very difficult to name something which makes the identity of that society. Indeed, to speak about identity today is actually a quite hot theme. Some people would already get quite angry if one dares to speak about identity and so on. But this means that it's an open question. And while before the identity, I don't know, of Venice of 15th century was quite evident or clearly there. And in a context where the identities have been almost destroyed, or let's say are much more difficult to define, let's say like this, then I think it's proportionally much more difficult to create art. And this is the reason, in my humble opinion, why it's more difficult to find great art. Not because there are the human potential would be lesser than before, but because the context. makes much more difficult the creation of a work of art. By the way, I was recently watching a film, and it's a little bit about this subject. It's a film called Werk ohne Autor, and I think the English translation is Never Look Away. It's a film of a German filmmaker. And very shortly, I just name it because it's really about what we are speaking of now. It speaks about, it tells the story of a painter who is born during the National Socialism. And so basically he then grows up and becomes a painter in the communist Germany. So he makes all his first experiences there. And then he escapes and he goes to Düsseldorf. And he goes in West Germany Academy. And it's very interesting because the film shows how both ways of understanding art are failing. So in the communistic, so let's say, socialist way approach, the art is useless if there is no concrete utility. So the teachers, the colleagues, they were telling him, the normal people do not need your art. So if you want to be a real artist, you should do something useful. So the biggest notion was it should be useful. Then when he escapes, he finds the opposite attitude. And he goes in this academy where the teacher doesn't even want to see the works of any of his students, and he always says, "You know by yourself if it is right or wrong." So, and this is a kind of, so of course, it's a film, but it's a way of telling, you know, the total freedom that the Western artists have, and also I am the judge of my artistry. But then the film shows very, very good, actually, how also that way doesn't work. And there is a kind of happy end, if you can say, because finally this painter finds a third way, and I am quite close to this way of thinking, because the character in the film finally will work on old photos and will finally make paintings from those old photos, which means something to him personally, which is a way to say, as far as I understand the film, is a way to say that today, in a society which has lost common references, maybe the only way to make real art is to propose a poetic transfiguration of our personal history, story, and our memory. And I like this answer, actually. And this also gives me hope. So I was speaking quite pessimistically now until now, but but this working on our memory, this is still possible. And indeed, I think there are some composers and artists who are doing this, and Kurtak, for example, or I could say the names of Berio, Takemitsu, and I think they have created really great masterpieces.
So, okay, well, let's maybe close with this, because I think we've covered a lot of really interesting territory. Yes. Well, what are your current projects then? What are you working on at the moment, and what's coming up? I mean, obviously after the world gets back to normal.
Yes, but we should. So first of all, we have Samuel Andreev CD, which just came out, as yes. Maybe you know.
Yes, I think so.
And I think we should concentrate on the promotion of this CD, of this transcendental music CD. Mm-hmm. Then with the orchestra, the current project, we are working on the recording of the 7th and 8th symphony of Beethoven, and also of another CD where the fairy tales are more the leitmotif, and it will be with Bartok, Debussy, and Stravinsky. So those are now the composers who are on my table every day. And in the next month also, I still keep playing cymbalum, and I'm very lucky to play together with Barbara Hannigan, and we play together Kurtag, so the duos for soprano and cymbalum, the trio for soprano, violin, and cymbalum, also by Kurtag. And this is, we have already played this program in other places, and we are going to play this quite soon in Vienna. So these are now the three next projects.
Fantastic. Well, thank you very much for taking the time to talk on this podcast.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
And we'll put some information in the description of the podcast about your activities, your website, and links, of course, to the new CD. The new CD that we have out is called Iridescent Notation. It's from Kairos Records, and it is available both as a paid download from Kairos and also as a physical CD. And the label has confirmed to me that they are still shipping orders. There's no problem getting CDs anywhere. And the digital release is a little bit pushed back because of the coronavirus, but it will be happening on May 1st. So more information about that will be coming soon.